This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Turkey's president told earthquake-stricken residents, "We are face-to-face with a great disaster," and called for patience as pain and anger mounted over loved ones lost while waiting for rescue workers. In northern Syria, the situation was already dire even before the quake struck.
This is an emergency within an emergency. In Syria, people were already suffering as it is, with a severely weakened infrastructure, depleted health system, shortages of necessities like water, electricity, you name it.
We try to understand the staggering toll of this disaster next on Forum. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The images coming from earthquake-stricken Turkey and Syria have been shocking. The stories, heartbreaking, as the death toll goes well past 11,000, more than 9,000 of those known deaths in southern Turkey. In Syria, more than 2,600 people have died, according to the State Health Ministry and the White Helmets Relief Group. Joining me now is Charles Lister, a senior fellow and director of the Syria and Counterterrorism and Extremism Programs at the Middle East Institute. Charles Lister, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
First, can you just tell us what you've been hearing about the situation on the ground in Syria?
Well, in Syria, it's kind of hard to come up with any more negative adjectives. It is as bad as you could possibly imagine. These people have experienced 12 years of some of the most brutal conflict we've seen in decades. 65% of the basic infrastructure in that northwestern region of Syria was already either destroyed or heavily damaged after those 12 years of war. So to have such an enormous earthquake strike, and to have it strike in the middle of the night while everyone was in bed, was, you know, quite literally the absolute worst case scenario. The biggest problem that they currently face right now is that the only sort of rescue workers available are the White Helmets, which were just mentioned. That's a force of about 2,000 to 3,000 volunteer civilians. None of them are paid, but that's 2,000 to 3,000 people working amongst a population of nearly 5 million. Wow. So they are beyond stretched. They were set up with international funding to respond to individual airstrikes, not a catastrophic apocalyptic earthquake that flattens most of everything that surrounds them. So they are really struggling, and not a single ounce of aid has managed to reach northwestern Syria 3 days after the earthquake.
Everything flattened around them at a time, as you say, Syria has already endured 12 years of war. We're hearing, of course, about the economic collapse, the food shortages, and the infrastructure issues there. But we were also hearing about a recent cholera outbreak.
Yes, yes, exactly. So right after the COVID pandemic whittled away in Syria, then they were hit by cholera. That's largely a reflection of deteriorated and damaged water infrastructure. People were basically forced to drink water from the Euphrates, big Euphrates River, and other basic natural water sources, all of which have been, riddled with cholera and many other parasites. So cholera is something that we have dealt with in Syria before. But yes, this latest sort of outbreak came at a particularly concerning time. And again, in the winter, when access to other kinds of resources is even harder than it normally is.
Yes, you're saying that aid is not getting through. Explain why aid is not getting through.
Well, so there's kind of two sides to this issue. In areas of Syria controlled by the regime in the north of the country, aid is getting in. So the Syrian regime, run by Bashar al-Assad, has so far in the last 3 days received humanitarian assistance from the United Nations and at least 12 other foreign governments. So that aid is being trucked mostly to areas in the north of the country that are controlled by the regime.
Yes.
It's this northwestern pocket of Syria controlled by the opposition that is essentially besieged now. The problem is we have one border crossing from southern Turkey into northwestern Syria that the United Nations is permitted to provide humanitarian assistance through. There used to be three, but the Russian government used its veto at the United Nations Security Council to close those border crossings, essentially an extension of what we've seen over the past 12 years, which is a siege and starve strategy targeting the opposition. That one border crossing that is technically still allowed to provide aid is cut off because the roads leading to it and from it were so heavily destroyed by the earthquake. The staff who normally run that border crossing have been killed, wounded, or are assisting family members who have been. And much of the infrastructure that the United Nations relies upon to provide aid across that border crossing was also damaged or destroyed during the earthquake. So there's this horrible situation where the only route through which help could come is shut off. And so there's right now a very big push by the international community, particularly by the Europeans, to reopen those other two border crossings that we used to use and to start providing humanitarian assistance across those borders without the United Nations, without a Security Council mandate or permission, but just doing it because of the humanitarian imperative, because people need this assistance and we're going to give it to them no matter what. And there are initial steps in that direction, but we're still some way away from it.
Yes. How is the Assad regime responding to that? I imagine they have no incentive to open up those alternative routes if it's to provide aid to rebel-held territories.
Yes. So the regime has made itself very, very clear. Its ambassador at the United Nations in New York said a couple days ago, you know, international community, please give us all the support you can, and we will deliver it to all Syrians all around the country. But you are not allowed and you do not have our permission to provide assistance from outside that doesn't go through our capital, Damascus. So they, of course, place that longstanding condition on things. And they know after 12 years that this is a serious vulnerability to this last bastion of sort of opposition or territory, that they are deeply vulnerable, they are cut off, and this is an opportunity for the regime to sort of sell an idea to the international community that the only way of helping these people is essentially to go through the regime and give the regime the power to determine who gets the aid and when. This is a pattern that's played out over the last 12 years. We know it very well. The United Nations has had to essentially submit itself to the regime's will for most of the past decade. And as a result of that, what we have seen is a systematic manipulation and diversion of humanitarian aid by the regime. And the little bits of aid that the regime has historically allowed into opposition areas, so somewhat conveniently, is stopped just before they get there. And then what we've seen is flour, you know, feces added to the flour shipments, shards of glass put in the wheat bags, and all the baby formula and medicines removed. So there's a significantly negative track record here. And so hopefully the international community is bearing all of that in mind when it comes to hearing these demands from the Syrian regime.
Even with all that, Charles Lister, given the desperate nature of the situation, do you think they should still try to route that through Damascus? Aid
well,
through
I
Damascus,
mean,
the international community?
It's a really good and important question. I mean, any avenue through which aid can go should be being utilized. So as cynical and skeptical as we rightly are about that route from Damascus up to the opposition-controlled northwest, it's still worth a try. If the regime is, in theory and on paper, offering to facilitate that, we should take them up on the offer. But the priority, the absolute priority here, is doing what's called cross-border and utilizing those border crossings from Turkey. It's a more direct route. We know that aid will not be interfered with, and we know that it will come in very significant quantities. And, you know, another sort of factual anecdote to throw in here is in 2022, over the past, 12 months, we were doing this. The international community was doing what's called cross-line aid, which is from Damascus into opposition areas, and cross-border from Turkey into opposition areas. Now, of all of the aid that the international community provided into northwestern Syria in 2022, 99.6% of it came cross-border from Turkey. And the cross-line assistance that the regime was willing to allow amounted to less than 0.5% of all the aid that went there last year. So yes, we should take the regime up on its offer, but we should also be very wide-eyed into the reality that it is not going to amount to very much.
We're talking with Charles Lister, Senior Fellow of the Middle East Institute in Washington. You, our listeners, can join the conversation. Do you have family or friends or ties to Syria or Turkey? Share what you are hearing and what you are going through here. You can email forum at kqed.org, find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum, or call us with your questions or concerns about what is going on there by calling 866-733-6786. I want to ask you about Turkey, Charles Lister, just for a moment. I understand while the situation wasn't as dire in Turkey as it was in Syria, it was very strained in Turkey before the earthquake. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Turkey's experiencing and has for a while now been experiencing an economic decline and economic struggles. The south of the country, which is where this earthquake has hit most strongly, also has a very significant population of Syrian refugees. And one thing we've seen, so technically speaking, in mid-May, we are supposed to have presidential elections in Turkey. And one of the most sort of contentious, but also one of the most significant issues within that election has become the issue of Syrian refugees. So the current government, led by President Erdogan, has long held a very supportive view towards the Syrian refugee population. I should say there's nearly 4 million Syrian refugees in southern Turkey. But President Erdogan's primary competitors inside Turkey have taken a very kind of aggressive tone against the Syrian refugees. They have blamed Syrian refugees for all of the ills that Turkey is facing, mostly economically. That I should say those are not sort of factual or logical accusations, but they're an easy scapegoat. So a lot of this sort of instability that we've seen in this southern region of Turkey in the last few months has circulated around this issue. Are Syrian refugees going to be sort of coercively expelled into Syria against their will? Are they going to stop receiving the sort of limited benefits from the Turkish state that they have until now? And so I know this isn't exactly the question you were asking, but that plays into this whole context of the earthquake. There's been significant pressure in the last 3 days against the government, accusing it of not responding sufficiently. I think some of those accusations may have something to go with them, but I think a lot of it is because of just the sheer disaster that has hit the region. But I think what is most likely here, and I worry about this, is that the Syrian refugee population in southern Turkey are going to be largely ignored by the Turkish state's response. That response is going to prioritize Turkish citizens, and those refugees are going to continue to be the vulnerable population that they have been for the past 10 years. And the last thing I'd say on this is, last year in 2022, the rate of illegal migration of Syrians towards Europe rocketed by over 100%. Those numbers are going to be dwarfed by what we see this year. They were already going to be dwarfed before this earthquake, but I think this earthquake guarantees a very significant refugee flow towards Europe again. And the last time that happened in 2015, the consequences were transformational. And that's what I think we may be seeing soon.
We're hearing about the impact of the earthquakes in Syria and Turkey, and we'll have more after the break on Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
This is Barbara Leslie, President of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the earthquakes that struck southeastern Turkey and northern Syria Monday, claiming now more than 11,000 lives, well past 11,000 lives in terms of a death toll. We're hearing about the humanitarian crisis unfolding. And we're going to hear now from people here with ties to the region. I'd like to bring into the conversation Perry Ottoman Holden, co-founder and volunteer with PAIDA, an education charity that serves southeastern Turkey. Perry Holden, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So I understand you serve families in southeast Turkey that are Turkish, Kurdish, and Syrian. You've been in constant contact with these families. What are they telling you?
Well, the situation is, we were all in shock. They were in shock. The situation started out awful. And to be honest, it's been getting worse by the day as the numbers keep going up and hope is diminishing because there are so many buildings that are completely flattened. The three regions, so 10 regions were affected in Turkey. Of those 10 regions, we have a main presence in three of them, Diyarbakir, Adana, and Malatya. But we have students in five of the others, and they're constantly sending photographs and news and calling. You know, 2:30 a.m. last night, they're calling me in tears. They can't find relatives. There's no help getting to them. They're all staying in various shelters across the city. And it's a devastating situation. And I feel the same for the Syrians across the border. It's hard to imagine and come to terms with the scope of the devastation in the area.
Yes, we've been hearing a lot about the challenges with rescue operations, hearing stories of people waiting in vain for rescuers to dig out family members that they could hear under the rubble. I imagine you are not hearing whether or not that is improving, that it has been more effective?
No, there's been also the difficulty is the temperatures are so cold that people surviving in their snow, very cold temperatures, for them to survive more than 2 days under heavy rubble is, they're still waiting outside, but I think hope is very little that they will be able to get people alive out. And there's lots of international aid coming, but logistically, it's been a disaster getting it to the places needed.
How are people staying warm? And what are they saying they need most?
Funny enough, when we ask them, what do you need most? Lots of doctors and medical staff from all over Turkey have gone there as volunteers. So they're sending lists of, they need gasoline and they need fuel because they're not able to use their cars. They have no transport. They're asking for medical supplies. A lot of hospitals and new built hospitals have collapsed. So that adds to the tragedy. Our students and their families, they're just praying. We're saying, what do you need? But getting things directly to them quickly is quite hard.
Yes, please continue.
And there's lots of local groups, volunteers, charities. People have jumped in their cars and sending trucks, etc. But a lot of them got caught up in Konya due to the bad weather. So everything's been delayed, and time is of the essence. So I'm afraid the most critical period has been lost to save people.
We have comments coming in, and I want to remind listeners that we're talking with Perry Holden, co-founder and volunteer with PAIDA, an education charity serving southeastern Turkey. Charles Lister is also with a senior fellow for the Middle East Institute in Washington, director of the Syria program and its counterterrorism program. You can join the conversation with your questions about the situation, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can email your comments or questions to forum@kqed.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. If you are hearing from family or friends in Syria or Turkey and want to let our listeners know what they are going through, feel free to share that as well. Ebru comments, for those who would like to make monetary contributions, donations to the Turkish-American organizations, Turkish Philanthropy Funds, and Empowering the Turkish-American Community USA go directly to nonprofit disaster relief organizations in Turkey, providing help in the disaster area. I imagine you are also being asked, Perry, what is the best way to help? What do you suggest?
There's a couple of organizations that I've given the links to you that are doing good work and are getting the help to the people who need them. One is Ahbap, one is Akut. If you're making donations from the U.S., Turkish Philanthropy Funds has a good website, and they're collecting donations. I think all of those are good. The government has two big entities, but right now most people are trying to go with sort of on-the-ground grassroots organizations.
Because there is skepticism about these government-sponsored organizations?
There is disillusionment, frustration, and skepticism because we've, in Turkey, since 1999 was the last big earthquake we had, and that was in the Gölcük area. And since then, Turkey has had a earthquake tax, which we have all been paying for the past, since 1999, for almost 24 years. So people are questioning where these funds have gone. Where is the more organized emergency services and rescue operations, which they're not seeing?
You're reminding me that KQED has compiled a list of groups raising funds to provide direct aid to Turkey and Syria, and that can be found on our website, kqed.org, and Twitter as well. Charles Lister, when you're hearing the skepticism with the government, I've also been hearing part of it is also fueled by the fact that there's real questions about the infrastructure there, infrastructure standards, the way that the government has handled the fact that it is so vulnerable to earthquakes.
Yeah, sure. I mean, just like we've seen, and just like we've seen in southern Turkey, inherent, deep-rooted shortcomings in terms of construction standards, does play a very significant role in creating vulnerability. So yes, I think that is, an element worth considering. But, frankly, after 12 years of the kind of war that we've seen in Syria, I think what's much more significant in terms of creating that sort of structural vulnerability is the war itself. And as I said, the key kind of hardest hit area of Syria in the northwest has borne the biggest brunt of the past 12 years of conflict. And as I say, 65% of the basic infrastructure was already destroyed or very heavily damaged. So it was a sort of sitting target for a natural disaster like this.
Perry, what are you most concerned about in terms of what comes next for the families that you are supporting?
I think for all of us, the sheer scale of the death toll that I see happening, there's predictions just based roughly on the number of buildings that have gone down. Right now, the government says it's around 10,000, our president said today when he visited. But the predictions are that it could be from 50 to 100,000 people. The region had 13 million people living. Hatay had 1 million people living, and more than half are unaccounted for. And right now, they're basically pulling out the dead, burying them. There's no time to identify people, so people don't know who's been taken out, who's been buried. It's a very sad situation. So I think all of this will sink in. And then, of course, comes the rebuilding of this huge area. And as Charles also said, we had elections that were announced for the 14th of May. I'm pretty sure that those will be delayed considerably because this area will not be in a situation to host elections. From our perspective, in terms of our students, our focus is on education of girls. And I also fear that education in the region will be will be greatly hampered because a lot of schools have been damaged, students killed, teachers killed. And for all of them, whether first physically and also mentally, to get back into education and to continue after what they've lived is not going to be easy.
You mentioned earlier, Perry, the terrible earthquake in 1999, and I understand you were in Turkey during that time. The death toll there, about 17,000 lives. I'm wondering how you compare...
The official death toll.
That's the official, yes, it's so, that's, right.
In Turkey, we have a difference between the official numbers and the what we believe are the true numbers. The official toll was 17,000. But I think the real toll was closer to 30,000. So we'll see what the official one comes out on this one, but I'm afraid it's going to be awful.
And that is what I wanted to ask you, just based on the kind of differences there were between that terrible earthquake and this one that come to mind for you. But also, I'm just curious about what that recovery process looked like, because what you're describing has just happened is on the order of magnitude much greater.
With that earthquake, there was a big building of earthquake-proof buildings in the İzmit, Gölcük area, and rehousing of people, which I'm sure will happen here too. And after in 1999, there was a very strict earthquake resistant building code put in place. So Turkey does have this building code, and it is very strict. I know it in depth, having done a construction recently. But the problem is that we have these construction codes and all these requirements and regulations, but the government comes along every year or so. They were about to do another one and does a amnesty, so that they look at all the buildings that were not done to code and they say, fine, there's a overall amnesty just before the elections or whatnot, and they're all fine, so you can live in them. And people buy these apartments and these buildings. A lot of the buildings that went down were new buildings. They should have been built according to this code, but they weren't.
Well, we've got a call from Carol in Foster City. Hi, Carol, you're on.
Hi. I was there in exactly that area about 11 years ago. I just think it needs to be pointed out that a large number of the people there are Kurds. They aren't Turks, both from Diyarbakir on east and in northern Syria. And I really sincerely worry about the degree of help they'll get. While I was there, I accidentally observed a massacre of Kurds by the Turkish military. And believe me, it's not an easy life to start out with. The degree of poverty in that area is beyond the belief of anybody in California. And I've lived in California all my 85 years. It's just a bad scene. And my heart goes out to them. And if I knew how to contribute, and I knew that the Kurdish people would get the money, that I would be assured it went that way, I'd really appreciate hearing about it. Thank you.
Well, Carol, thanks. Well, first, Perry, let me go back to you, because the families you serve, some are, in fact, Kurdish.
To be honest, that area, Diyarbakir, Mardin, that area is all Kurdish. I mean, here's the thing. They are Kurdish, but they are Turkish. And I know the government has this agenda with the PKK that, you know, Kurds does not equal PKK and terrorism. And most of my students are Kurdish. They speak Kurdish, they speak Turkish, and they are getting the equal help and support from our side. And also at the moment, all the students that are in shelter or that are getting help are getting the same help as the Turkish students.
Charles Isser, do you have any thoughts on Carol's concerns?
I think from the outside, I think it's very right and understandable to be concerned, given the divisions that we know exist, as Perry just made very clear. I think, you know, in an emergency situations like this, I also would sort of warn against creating these lines of division. This is an emergency situation where civilians, no matter who they are, will be receiving any and all of the aid that they can receive. Another point to make would be that there's a Kurdish angle to this as well in Syria, albeit the Kurdish regions of northern Syria were significantly less badly hit than the northwest. But they are receiving some assistance via the KRG in northern Iraq. My general message is, and I think as Perry was, I think, suggesting as well, in an emergency situation like this, everyone is a victim. And it would be quite surprising if we genuinely did see a differentiation in how different populations were treated. I would add the Syrian refugee population is likely a much more likely exception to that rule than the domestic Kurdish population in Turkey.
Again, Charles Lister is senior fellow with the Middle East Institute, director of the Syria and Counterterrorism Programs. And you, our listeners, are joining the conversation, 866-733-6786, the number to call, email address forum at kqed.org, post at KQED Forum on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Paul tweets, NGOs always face challenges responding to disasters in areas under sanctions, not just in disasters, but ongoing conflict situations. The UN and US are starting to make changes, but more fundamental humanitarian allowances are needed. Charles, can you talk a little bit about what the U.S. needs to do to help these war-torn areas, these conflict zones, as Paul is bringing up, like Syria? But what can it do to help Syria in this situation? I imagine aid will need to be increased, but there's a real question as to whether that would happen. And given the history of how hard it's been to get even the aid that's been agreed to.
Sure. So, I mean, I'm glad this came up because it has become quite a significant subject of discussion over the last several days. And I'm glad it's come up because I think things need to be sort of clarified in the Syrian case. So it is right to say that the Syrian regime has come under very significant sanctions pressure from the United States, United Kingdom, the European Union and Canada. Those are the main four sanctioning bodies. But it is also important to note that those sanctions are punitive. They are specifically directed at specific individuals and entities involved in war crimes over the last 12 years. And all of those sanctions and all of those sanctioning bodies have specific legislation in place that what is called waives all humanitarian assistance to be unaffected by sanctions activities. An even more important angle to this issue is that but the vast majority of the humanitarian assistance that goes into Syria goes into Damascus. It is channeled through the Syrian regime. And of all of that assistance, 91% of it is funded by the four sanctioning entities, the United States, Canada, the European Union, and the United Kingdom. So the idea that somehow sanctions against the regime is impeding humanitarian assistance, it's honestly a myth. And it has fast become a regime talking point in situations like this, where the desperation faced by people, it provides a very good opportunity to sell this argument. On a factual level, there is nothing to substantiate the claims. So that 90% of the humanitarian assistance will continue to be funded by our governments, and it will continue to go through the regime channeled by the United Nations. Nothing is going to stop that. And it has been the case for the past 12 years, and it will continue to be.
Listeners, we're talking about the impact of the earthquakes in Syria and in Turkey. There have been multiple ones, even after the 7.8 magnitude quake that struck. And you, our listeners, are invited to ask your questions about how the Syrian and Turkish governments will handle the situation, the political situation in either country, as we have Charles Lister with us of the Middle East Institute and Perry Altman of PIDA. Also, you can share if you have family or friends or ties to Syria or Turkey. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, the smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. More than 11,000 people are dead and countless more injured or displaced after earthquakes devastated southern Turkey and northern Syria. Rescue workers in Turkey struggled to free people from the rubble as cold weather swept the region. And the quakes have compounded a years-long humanitarian crisis in Syria, racked by war. We're taking a closer look at the scale of this crisis and ways you can help. Charles Lister is Senior Fellow and Director of the Syria and Counterterrorism and Extremism Programs at the Middle East Institute. Perry Ottoman-Holden is co-founder and volunteer with PIDA, an education charity serving southeastern Turkey. And joining me now is Nalan Güngör Uçuşuk, president of the Turkish American Association of California. Nalan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you so much for paying attention to this human tragedy.
You have friends and people in your association as well who have been sharing stories with you about family members. Can you please let us know what they are hearing and what they are telling you?
The situation in this area is very horrifying, and we are just watching as the death toll is increasing. Locally in the Bay Area, we have a number of either my personal friends or community members whose first degree parents, cousins, grandchildren, grandkids, so on, who have been severely affected. So we are all crumbling to find a way to assist them directly and also try to provide some comfort shoulder to those friends who are unable to just fly there and then help the family members. And so it's a very chaotic situation. The emotions are running high, and at the same time, keeping cool and see what we can do, how we can help them. It's not easy. So we are talking, crying together, and collecting money, collecting some items such as sleeping bags, blankets, diapers, baby formulas. The area is known with very harsh winter. And as you can imagine, the roads are collapsed. It's very cold. So we are doing what we can to help them.
So people are saying they need sleeping bags, baby formula, diapers. Yeah.
As of right now, I used to be a journalist in Turkey, so my journalist friends are all in those regions. So every contact I am having is one-to-one with a person who is right there. So what I am hearing and then receiving from them is that the weather is very cold, the winter is harsh, so people need tents and sleeping bags, not just a simple thick fleece blanket. And the children, babies need diapers, baby formulas, and as much as we can send over-the-counter simple pain medications, cough medications. Those are the number one. And locally, they are in need of food, basic water, bread. So this is what they actually need. So Turkish Airlines is partnered with American Turkish Embassy, in Washington, D.C. So we local organizations are collecting donations. We are sorting them out and properly packing them. and take them to the Turkish Airlines cargo in like San Francisco, in LA, in Miami, in New York, wherever the Turkish airline is flying. And Turkish airline is taking those items to Istanbul, and they will be giving to local government agency, and hopefully agency will be able to take them to Antep, Kahramanmaraş, Malatya, wherever they are needed.
Yeah, so you're taking these items to the airports, you're saying?
Yes, we are. We are. So
I see.
If that's okay, I'd like to give you a couple of websites.
Yes, go ahead.
One is our own organization, local organization, Turkish American Association of Northern California. And our website is www.tcharlieaapple.org. Anyone who can help us will find the information. And other website that is collecting monetary donation heavily is www.tfumpsinpeter.org.
I am so struck, Nalan, hearing you talk about also being a shoulder for people here to cry on when there is a natural disaster or other disasters in countries where we have family and friends that are outside the U.S. There is such a feeling of wanting to help, and also at the same time, even as you are trying to do what you can, this feeling of helplessness. Is that something people have communicated to you?
That is the hardest part. I've been up for 3 nights, and I thought this conversation was going to be on TV, so I had to go and take a quick shower. That is the hardest part. That is the hardest part, is that it's just like here, what happened in Katrina. I remember what happened in Katrina so clearly. I remember what happened in Iran or what happened in Turkey in 1999. That is the hardest part. You want to help, and we all can do something, even if it's a dollar or packet of child, baby diaper, but not being able to just go there and give those people or talk to them. It's not the same. We are watching the news, all of us. It's horrified. The number is increasing. Number is increasing. Yeah, so tonight, for instance, we will get together at the Turkish restaurant Sultana in Menlo Park at 7 p.m. On the purpose is basically we will sit and talk what we are doing. Yeah, you need some emotional place that just where emotions are spoken without money, without this and that. That is also as important as providing assistance. So it hurts. It hurts, especially we have friends whose parents died. I know her family, entire family died.
Well, Nalan, I cannot thank you enough for making the time to be with us when you have not even been sleeping, and to help our listeners understand the toll that this takes and the ripple effect it has on all of us, and mostly, of course, the people who are so directly affected that your organization is trying to help. Thank you for the work that you do. Nalan Güngör Özışık is president of the Turkish American Association of California, and we are talking about the devastation, trying to wrap our minds around the staggering toll of the earthquakes that have struck southern Turkey and northern Syria. You, our listeners, are also asking questions. Robert tweets, what about airdrops of aid into the earthquake area? Charles Lister, airdrops, would that be something that the regime would allow in Syria, northern Syria, northwestern Syria?
In theory, I would say if track records are anything to go by, then no, the regime would certainly be opposed. Would it stand up and actually confront airdrops? Very unlikely, given the consequences. So its rhetorical position would probably differ from its practical one. You know, the Turkish military operates an airfield, an airstrip in northern Syria. So it is in theory possible, if coordinated and facilitated with Turkey, to do exactly that, to begin airdropping supplies into the heart of northwestern Syria, into this Turkish airstrip, and then disseminating them from there. It just requires international will. We have to want to do this to make it work. And at the moment, quite frankly, what we've heard from the international community is we're flooding Turkey with all of the assistance it needs, and absolutely rightfully so, as we've just heard from Nalan and from Perry. But the Syria angle is sort of an afterthought, and particularly the Syrian angle with relation to the 5 million people living in the opposition corner of the country. And to an extent now, all we've really heard is, well, our NGO partners in northwestern Syria will continue to respond to the crisis. Well, our NGO partners are a million miles from being in a position to truly meaningfully and effectively respond to the crisis that's at hand right now. And so it's disappointing, to say the least. But as I said earlier, there are efforts to try and create a better response. But 3-4 days late, and as we've heard from all the other guests, you know, it's the height of winter. They've had heavy rain, snow and sleet every night since the earthquake. And thousands and thousands of bodies remain under the rubble, probably more than that. And so, you know, it's taking far too long.
Yes, for the people, we had heard from Perry as well, just the death toll. She fears 50,000, 100,000, who, you know, it's so hard to know at this stage, but then just countless more who will be displaced. Can you just give us a sense of the ripple effect that this will have across the world? How many people will be displaced and will need to migrate?
So, well, on the Turkey side of the equation, that some of the numbers that are being put out right now are extraordinary. Some experts were saying last night that the eventual toll could be as high as 180,000. And I think that speaks to the magnitude of the destruction and the fact that it takes weeks and weeks and weeks to sort of reveal the scale of these disasters. 3 days is sadly not anywhere near enough to figure out just how bad things have been. But I don't think, so clearly we've seen a vast number of Turkish citizens displaced. But I think if we're talking about more sort of international effects, the worry is, as I stated earlier, about Syrian refugees and the Syrian displacement crisis. You know, inside northwestern Syria, there are about 4.5 million people. 3 million of them are already displaced. They were displaced before the earthquake. Most of them were already living in tent camps. So the Turkish government has essentially shut the borders to prevent any further refugee flows. But the sheer extent of destruction is going to be another driver of people who will take desperate measures, probably, to escape Syrian territory. And as I was saying earlier as well, the Syrian refugees who are in Turkey are sadly unlikely to receive the same level of assistance as Turkish citizens. Yes. And they have already a track record of fleeing towards Europe over the past 12 months in very significant numbers compared to the several years that preceded it. And those numbers are likely to significantly rise. And the last time this happened, it precipitated Brexit and the European and the UK's exit from the European Union, the rise of far-right politics all across Europe, and potentially even here in the United States with the election of the Trump administration. That whole refugee, anti-refugee sentiment and the targeting of the others, any other, did, frankly, yes, you know, begin with that Syrian refugee crisis. So if it happens again, I'm worried.
The ripple effect of the earthquake in Syria and Turkey. This is a fundraising period for many public radio stations. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Charles Lister, I have to ask you, the prospects of recovery are hard to wrap our minds around in Turkey, as Perry has shared with us. I'm wondering if it's even, and I hate to ask this, but what that could even look like in Syria. Is there a future where recovery is not possible? And especially the northwestern region that is held by, that is rebel territory, essentially becoming uninhabitable for a long period of time.
Yeah, well, we've been heading in that direction for many years, and this has accelerated that path for sure. The wider Syrian crisis is a very long way from being resolved. There's no real light at the end of the tunnel in terms of there being ever being a sort of true resolution. And it is going to take a genuine negotiated settlement or some kind of a resolution to the wider Syrian crisis for any form of serious reconstruction of the whole country to become a realistic expectation. And there's just no sign of it. And to be frank with you, the United States government, both the tail end of the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration, has shown no interest whatsoever in trying to truly resolve the Syrian crisis. They've largely disengaged. And if there is ever going to be something, some movement in that direction, it is frankly going to take a US push alongside allies and partners to say enough is enough. It's been nearly 13 years now. This Syrian crisis must be resolved and the regime has to start to constructively engage in negotiations. But if that doesn't happen, then yes, every corner of Syria is going to remain in the levels of destruction that they currently are. And sadly, this northwestern corner is going to be the absolute hardest hit.
Listener John tweets, the Karam or Karam Foundation is an amazing U.S.-based NGO already serving kids and families in affected areas of Syria and Turkey. Please support their relief efforts. Perry, I understand that you go back to Turkey or have been on a monthly basis. What are you thinking about when you will be able to return?
People from Paida are going there next week to Malatya because we had a lot of students who've lost their homes there. I will go probably in the next month to month and a half, I'm hoping. In the meantime, we've been collecting funds and we'll be helping the families that that we support. The government has brought certain restrictions in terms of who can collect money due to the earthquake within Turkey in terms of charities. So we're able to collect money and funds for our own students, but not for anything beyond that because they want everything centralized. The other difficulty is, as you've probably heard, Twitter has been pretty much restricted, banned as of this afternoon in Turkey, which has caused a huge outcry because Twitter was a very, it was very key in the sharing of information in terms of health and situation. But the government saw it as a way to criticize it and bring its shortcomings to the media. So that's you were asking what was the difference between the 1999 earthquake and this one. That was a huge difference. We didn't have social media then and the sharing of information and immediate news, which we did have. We do have now. But again, restriction on Twitter has not been good today.
Yes, I have heard about that and did want to ask you about the fact that that was happening and why. And you just gave us the reason that it will invite criticism of the government. But at a time when we really do need the information that is coming from them to better understand the situation and what can be done to help. And so thank you so much for being those information sources for us today. Perry Holden, co-founder and volunteer with PIDA, really appreciate having you on.
Thank you very much.
Charles Lister, senior fellow and director of the Syria and Counterterrorism and Extremism Programs at the Middle East Institute, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And my thanks to Nalan Güngör Özışık, president of the Turkish American Association of California, for joining us, and also listeners for sharing your questions and reflections. Caroline Smith and Susie Britton produced today's segment. You've been listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising Simons Foundation.
This is Barbara Leslie, president of the Oakland Port Commission. Oakland International Airport, OAK, is proud to bring you this podcast of KQED's Forum. When you're choosing your next adventure, The smart and convenient choice is to fly the East Bay Way from OAK to destinations across the USA and Mexico. And when you return home, tune in to KQED, always bringing us remarkable stories about who we are and where we live. Enjoy today's episode of Forum.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.